Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Good morning, Matt.
Morning, Stu.
Here we are, Thrive Deeper, and in the book of Matthew.
Yep.
And picking up from chapter 13. And some very, and again, I know we say this every time, but some very familiar stories here. But with that comes the danger of us kind of just skipping it over it and going, yeah, I know that, and not allowing it to really sink in and to see what the Holy Spirit wants to say to us through it each time we read it. So,
well, there's always a lot more than meets the eye here because there's a lot of, particularly in Matthew, there's a lot of Old Testament background that adds a whole lot more depth to things that, yes, are otherwise quite familiar.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I'm looking forward to telling us all about that, Matt. So we're going to kick in from Matthew chapter 13, listeners, if you've got your Bible there. Grab that out and let's follow along.
Or if you haven't, you're listening while you're walking or driving.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're driving, definitely don't follow along with your Bible.
That's a good point, Matt. Yeah, really good point.
Probably, I think it's important just to remind ourselves where we finish up. Context is everything, Stu, when we look at these stories. And, you know, in the Gospels, there is a sequence. The way that the accounts are put together is important. And the last thing that we covered in Matthew chapter 12 was this moment when Jesus' mother and brothers are there in the midst of the crowd, and you know, someone says, "Here are your mother and brothers," and Jesus says, takes the moment. No, he's not repudiating his mother and brothers, but he takes that moment to make a point, and he says, "Who are my mother and brothers? Whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." And so he's sort of redefining what familial relationships actually are in the kingdom of God. That it's not, because he's putting the, remember, Matthew's interested in what is it, who are the true disciples?
Yes.
And in a sense, who is the true Israel? And he's going to really be showing us, and Jesus is going to make this point, that the true Israel are those who have faith, of the faith of Abraham. This is a point that Paul makes as well. You know, but those who respond actually to him in particular, who have, as he's going to go on to say, who have ears to hear and eyes to see. Yeah. So there's this delineation. This is important from this moment on, because up to this point, Jesus has been with the crowds. He's done all these amazing things. He's taught very openly. He's openly done many miracles. But now there's a refinement that's going to happen. And it's interesting, this pattern, you actually see this pattern, Stu, in the narratives throughout the Old Testament. You get this gradual refining. It's the remnant theology of that works right through the Old Testament narratives, where you get this refinement of who is part of God's people. You know, there's the 12 tribes of Israel, and then it's honed down to, you know, a couple of southern tribes, which becomes, you know, the tribe of the Judah or the Jews.
Become a remnant of Babylon.
Jews, they go into Babylon, and even then a remnant, you know, only a remnant of the Jews returns, and then so forth. So you get this remnant, this continual refinement, and Jesus is going to essentially continue that process of refining, you know, who is truly God's people. Already in the Sermon on the Mount, he's talked about the broad way and the narrow way. And he's not talking about the whole world. He's even talking amongst his people, that there is a remnant. That's a kind of expression, that broad way, narrow way thing is an expression of that remnant theology. So at this point, he has, and we should remember as well, he's been going mainly to Jewish areas.
Yes.
We're going to see in the section we're going to look today, he makes a foray out into Gentile territory. It's very, very interesting that he does this at this point, right? Because so far he's gone first to, as he is going to put it, to the lost
sheep of Israel,
right? It's interesting that they're referred to like that, they're lost sheep, because they don't see it like that.
Yes.
Okay, and that's part of the problem. But he is going, you know, amongst the towns of Israel, he's performing these miracles very openly. He's teaching very openly. But now there's a refinement. Now he's going to start kind of shutting people out in a way.
Well, yeah. Yes, I guess up until this point, he's spoken pretty straightforward. I mean, the Sermon on the Mount, you know, it needed a little
I
bit of...
I can understand your hesitation when you're saying that.
Needed a little bit of unpacking, but now he recognises the crowds are getting bigger, and he really wants, I think, I'm feeling like he really wants to make sure that the teaching gets to the people who really are going to make a difference in terms of disciples.
Yeah, that's a very nice way of putting it, Stu. I think he expresses it more strongly, actually. He is actually wanting to be more particular, like he's...
polarized.
He wants to speak to those who have ears to hear, really.
Yep.
But the first thing he's going to do is explain why some people are receptive and some people are not.
Yes.
And, but he's actually going to... This is also a justification for why he speaks in parables. And he's going to use the illustration of a sower who sows seed. Mm. And the sower that sows seed is the famous parable of the sower, which begins in Matthew 13, probably should be called the parable of the soils.
Yes.
Really.
Yes. Because the sower is the same and the seeds are the same.
That's right. It's the soils that are different. And you get these different kinds of soil. You get that that falls along the path. That's the... He's going to actually interpret the first parable for him, but what we gather is that, he sows along the path, which is the hard-heartedness, other seed, on rocky ground, which is, some good soil but shallow.
Mm.
Then he's going to sow on soil that's good but is overcrowded by other weeds.
Yep.
And so the seed's going to be choked, but then there's the good soil. And essentially what Jesus is going to do from here is that he's going to be more selective about where he sows the seed, essentially. He's going to be focusing on the good soil. Now the disciples don't... This doesn't mean... The disciples who are the immediate circle, let's say, of the willing... I mean, it's somewhat good soil, but there are also problems there as well. It's not certainly... They're not without their problems, and they're going to misunderstand a lot of things. And it's interesting because... They supposedly have ears to hear, and yet they don't still quite get. They have to still be trained as to how to understand these parables.
And that's because really the truth of the kingdom is by revelation, not just by figuring it out.
Yeah.
Really. It requires a revelation, and Christ is giving the revelation to his disciples.
Yeah. And this is also, this is sort of something new. I mean, it's new, but it's not new. I mean, Jesus, he's certainly moving things forward.
Mm.
But, a lot of what he's saying is already there in the Old Testament, and that's where a lot of these sections of teaching do have roots in the Old Testament. Everything is very continuous here, and yet there is something new about this as well. Also, I should say, there are plenty of parables in the Old Testament as well. I mean, famously, the parable that Nathan brings to David after David commits the sin with Bathsheba.
Mm.
And, Nathan comes to him and he tells him the story about the rich man and the poor man and so forth. And David doesn't see himself in the parable. It's a classic example of a parable.
Mm.
And David at that point doesn't really have ears to hear. He's got this protectiveness.
Mm.
And it's only when Nathan says, "You are that man," that David, clicks really. And so that is important background for this sort of thing. Like, in a sense, a lot of these parables are meant to, they're about what's happening at the time and so forth. But we'll go through them. And
I think also that there's a bit of a danger in that we know these parables probably if we've been, people in the Word for a few years. We know many of these parables, and it's very easy just to read them through as though that relates to someone else. But there's great application, I think, for us through these parables. And, even if we look at the sower and the seed, for instance, I was just reflecting in my own life about what that might look like for me when the Word of God is brought, and even if we just think about my daily Bible reading or a Sunday message I might hear at church, the seed falls on the roadside and I'm just too busy even to get to church, perhaps, and I don't even hear it. Or it falls on the stony ground and it's like, oh, wow, yeah, I really need to change that in my life. And then I walk out and have a coffee and by the time I'm driven out of the car park or whatever it might be, it's gone.
Yeah.
It's the intent starts really strongly. We can get distracted by all the things that are going on in the world and the thorny ground. There's all this other stuff that's keeping us busy and we're not applying the Word. So I think it's important as we read through a number of these parables to really think about what God might be trying to say to each of us through this, not just read it as historical narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we definitely need to, you know, this is talking about us and how we live our lives. Yeah. Absolutely. The soil, by the way, Stu, you know, the good soil. I mean, there's a this idea of having ears to hear and eyes to see is an interesting one, because it sort of harks back. And again, we've got to read everything here through the lens of what we've been prepared for through the prophets. So for example, in, you know, Jeremiah talks about God making a new covenant with his people, and he will put his spirit within them so that they will know, you know, he will write the law on their hearts. You know, he says, I'm going to write my law on your hearts, right? It's the shaping of the heart. Ezekiel, in Ezekiel chapter 36, talks about taking away a heart of stone and giving you a heart of flesh.
Yes.
So it's the regeneration of the heart that's described in Jeremiah and Ezekiel that is in view here, that there is a work of the spirit on the heart of people. And presumably a sort of a kind of openness, a spirit-created openness that is described here. But it's not we need not see it in a fatalistic thing. Oh, there are some people that are open, there's some are not, and it's just, it's all sort of predetermined. Now, there is an element of God's sovereignty, and I'm always, you know, that is a big theme in scriptures, recognize the sovereignty of God over everything here. But yet, you know, Jesus goes on to say, when he's asked by the disciples, why suddenly you're talking these riddles?
Yes. Like,
because they're concerned that, you know, they've got these crowds. They're thinking, this is great, right? Yep. We've got the crowds. This is what you want, right? Yep. If you're going to start a movement, they're stoked, right?
Yeah.
And so suddenly he starts talking these riddles. They're like, what, mate? What are you doing? Mm. Like, you. Mm. Like, people are...
You're giving us a bad reputation, mate.
Well, you know,
you're confusing everybody.
Yeah, you're sort of compromising your popular following. I mean, you know, potentially, you know, people are going to start turning away and thinking, what is this guy talking about? And they're all going to go home. Mm. Now, Jesus is absolutely okay with that, totally. You know, because he's not into the crowds. He's calling disciples. And so his explanation in verse 12, he says, for to the one who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away.
Yeah.
That's a really important principle, because the idea is, if you are willing, if your heart, you've got an open, willing heart, then you'll be given more, right? God will soften your heart more. You know, if you're open to the Spirit of God, then the Spirit of God will give you even more openness, right? Mm-hmm. If you're willing to see, you will be given sight. If you're willing to hear, you will be given a greater capacity to hear from God. Mm-hmm. But if you're not, even what you can hear will be taken away. And, you know, you think of the classic example of this is God hardening Pharaoh's heart during the time of the Exodus, right? Yep. So he was kind of, okay, let's hear this Moses guy out, you know, but because he was not really willing, God sort of compounded that hardness and that hard-heartedness, and it got worse and worse and worse. So this is what we see here is Jesus essentially saying, I'm going to start polarizing things now. So those who are willing will be more willing, and those who are reticent are going to become more completely worse. Hard-heartedness. So I'm going to soften some hearts, and I'm going to harden other hearts for the sake of polarizing. This is a very interesting effect that Jesus has from this point on. I mean, he's already had a polarizing effect. Yeah. And this is the thing, when Jesus comes into our lives, he brings out both the best and the worst, right? This is the polarization effect. So we see things clearly. Yeah. And it's how we respond to that determinative of how well we will move forward. So are we willing to repent of what the bad that we see and cultivate the good? That's the key thing here. So anyway, so we're going to see this more and more and more. Jesus is going to have this polarizing effect.
And in a sense, what you're saying there, are we willing to hear the things about ourselves that we really don't want to hear and then do something about them?
Yeah.
Because often our inclination is to kind of shut that down, push it away and not actually hear it at all and move on with life.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And it's interesting that he goes on to say in verse 16, I mean, he quotes there from Isaiah, you know, again, the quotes are important because he's saying none of these ideas are new. This is what Isaiah confronted. As well. But he says to the disciples, but blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear, right? Now, at this point, they have something, but he's going to give them more. This is the point. So they are the ones, you know, the one who has more will be given. So they have something. Now, they don't get what he's talking about. They're like every, in a sense, at this stage, they're a bit like everyone else.
Mm.
They have the same, they still somewhat have the same misconceptions about the Messiah. That's going to be become clear in Matthew 16 when Peter acknowledges that Jesus is the Messiah, yes. but then harbors completely wrong ideas about what that means, right? Mm. So there's still these sort of ambitions there. There's still lots of problems going on in their hearts, but there's a willingness there as well. And this is important, Stu, because it, because some people think, oh, I keep finding bad motivations in my heart. No, as long as there's some willingness there,
yeah.
if you come to God with that, he will expand that. That's what Jesus is saying here.
And the point with these guys is they'd all given up their lives. So they've already sort of said, we're going to put our lives. Now, they don't know everything. They don't understand everything, but they've made the commitment to step in to be with Jesus and
they have.
To learn from him. And that's kind of the, in a sense, the biggest step of opening your eyes and
that's right.
opening your ears. You know?
Although let's not, well, I'm going to say let's not give them too much credit. I mean, I want to just say that cautiously.
Yes.
Remember these guys, for them, Jesus being the Messiah meant that they are going to get the key plate. You know, this is there's potentially an opportunism mixed in here,
yeah,
okay?
Sure.
There's genuinely a sense, okay, when they were called, they followed him immediately, right? Mm. There was a move of God, okay? It's the same with, you know, there was a point in my life where God called me and it was absolutely this move of God. Now, I came in with all of my wrong motives and messed up, you know, expectations, and God has been refining those. That's right. God has been refining those over the years. And this is the same thing with these guys. I mean, they absolutely respond to a move of God. Their hearts were open, but there's lots of problems here as well.
For us.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and I guess that's the point I was trying to make. It's like we're always going to be fighting these things, but if we're constantly staying close to Jesus Christ, to the Lord, reading our word, that's going to open our
that's
ears
right.
and open our eyes.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why, you know, he's going to step them through this very mercifully, right? He's going to step them through this, right? Okay, let me explain it to you. And the parables, the key parables that he's going to share here, he's going to give explanations well. But there are not a lot of explanations that he gives. It's just here he's giving them a key to understanding. And this is, and I think it's the key that we see here is that each parable is given to make a specific point. We've got to be careful that we don't allegorize every single element of every parable. It's not saying one particular thing.
That's right.
Because any illustration, you can't apply it in every way. A parable has got to be applied in the way that it was intended.
And he's used things that are common to the people of the day in terms of his illustration spot.
Yeah. So one of the big issues that he's going to address here through these parables, Stu, is this expectation of the Jewish people for a political Messiah that's going to change their circumstances. Now, we talked about this in, I think it was the first episode, with the announcement that, you know, you shall call him Jesus, he says to Joseph, because he'll save his people from their sins. Now, there was a lot of other things that they wanted to be saved from. Their sins wasn't one of them.
That's
right?
Down the list a bit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're suffering significant political oppression, right?
Yes.
So, So they're expecting a Maccabean-style Messiah, you know, the warrior.
Kick these guys out.
Let's kick the Romans
out.
We
want to be the ruling
That's right. That's
again.
That's what's forefront in their minds. And so in as much as Jesus is announcing the kingdom of God is at hand, he's been saying that. So they all think, oh, great, you know, let's go out, let's take up our swords and let's kick the Romans out and establish an independent Jewish state, you know, again, like happened a couple of hundred years before under the Maccabeans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but no, that's not. So he has to correct that. This is an important lesson, Stu, because in our humanness and in our impatience, we want to go the forceful, revolutionary, sudden sort of way, right? We've got to get political power, right? Mm. And we've got to wield the tools of this world, the weapons of this world, the power weapons of this world, and sort of enforce the kingdom
Legislate
of God.
Legislate our morality, in a
sense. That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jesus essentially in these parables saying, no, don't do that, right? That's not the plan right now. And he illustrates this, first of all, by the parable of the mustard seed that becomes the tree. It's a mustard seed. You push it into the soil, right? And it's little and it grows gradually, like, but gradually it turns into a great tree. Now, the background to this is important, Stu, because in Daniel chapter 4, there is this story about Nebuchadnezzar has this dream where this great tree grows, and it's the same, exactly the same language is used. Its branches spread out and the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. And it's a worldly kingdom, right? And then in his dream, the tree gets cut down, right? And Daniel explains to Nebuchadnezzar, this is your kingdom, right? It's this is you. From a seed, you've turned into a great tree, and but God is going to cut that tree down. So the parable of the mustard seed is forming a very important contrast to that. So it's making a point, but it's saying this kingdom, this is going to be a powerful kingdom, right? This is not going to be a Nebuchadnezzar-style empire that we're going to found. Because in a sense, this is what they wanted, right?
Yeah.
So by alluding to, you know, Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he's also making a distinction. It's not going to be like that because that tree was cut down, right? So it's not going to be that kind of tree, but it's still going to be a kingdom, a different kind of kingdom, but it's going to be an everlasting kingdom, right? And so that's important background for that. And, you know, a tree grows gradually and slowly. But the other, and this is a clarifying, you know, because parables clarify parables. And the other one, example he uses is the yeast and the dough.
Yes.
Right. This is not going to be an imposing kingdom, you know, sort of imposed on the world. This is like we're going to take, you know, a little bit of dough with yeast, and this is how they did it. You take a little bit of dough that has the yeast in it. You mix it in with the dough, and gradually it's gradually spreads throughout the in this sort of grassroots internal sort of way. And he's explaining here how the kingdom of God is going to come. Now, this is remarkable, Stu, because he is predicting that this kingdom is going to spread throughout the world. And of course, as
we see
what is actually happening. We're seeing that. Totally. But it's the how that's important here. It's not in this imposing political military way. It's in this spiritual, like that, this living yeast in the dirt's going to spread throughout the whole thing, right? And so that's important. And then the parable of the weeds, I think, further, again, there's a cumulative thing going on here, because the parable of the weeds, he describes a field and the evil one sows seeds. There's the seeds of God and the seeds of the evil one in the field, right? And the crops grow together. And the point here that Jesus is making in the parable of the weeds, because, you know, his servants come to them and say, look, there are someone sowed weeds. Should we go and root them up? Now, this is the important thing. Remember, a parable is given for a specific, very specific purpose here. And the important point here is that Jesus is saying, don't go uprooting weeds. The ministry now is not to go in and uproot them. Leave the weeds. Let them grow, right? Let it go. Don't focus on evil. Don't focus on all the terrible things that are happening out there. Focus on sowing the seed, right? Cultivating the wheat, because God will take care of
the weeds.
See, in other words, another way of putting this, our job is not judgment. That's God's job, right? So don't be out there playing judge as to who is the weeds and who is the wheat and uprooting the weeds. Now, of course, this is important context because in the land, the field, in a sense, could be seen as, well, the field is the world, of course, but for Jewish people, they're dealing with a circumstance where there's Romans spread throughout the land. And a lot of what I'll describe as Hellenized Jews as well, like Jews that had taken on the Greco-Roman culture. And so, man, weeds and wheat. You know, you've got very religious people, but you've got, you know, mix, you know, but there are, you know, Romans in the land. There are, you know, Hellenized Jews in the land. It's a real mixture. And the expectation was of Jesus that he would denounce and uproot the evil people from the land. In fact, in like Psalm 125 and, you know, talks about the scepter of the evil one will not remain over the land. And there are lots of promises about God uprooting the evil from the land. And so they're thinking, oh, Jesus is going to come and he's going to uproot the evil, you know, evil people from the land. And we're going to be his instruments. And in fact, the Jewish people are going to try that. they're in the 60s, a generation, I mean, Jesus predicted this, a generation later, they're going to rise up against the Romans and try to uproot the weeds, what they see as the weeds, right? Yeah. And it's going to lead to absolute disaster. Okay. Yeah. And Jesus knows this. And in a sense, he's warning them here, but he's also saying to his people, the kingdom of God isn't going to come through uprooting the weeds. It's going to come through the cultivation of the wheat. So, you know, I think this is actually about the kingdom mission.
Right.
Remember, Matthew's interested in discipleship and what it means to be a disciple and to make disciples. And essentially what this is saying, just focus on make disciples, right? Don't be moral. Don't go out being moral crusaders.
Yeah, that's great. Yep.
It's the perennial kind of temptation of Christians, and we see it even today, that we revert to being moral crusaders, right? We're going to enforce Christian legislation on our society. We're going to stand against sin.
And often, Matt, that's what the church mostly has heard in terms of out in the world, is what we're opposed to.
Exactly.
What we're against.
Exactly.
And not enough about what we think's good, you know?
Exactly. In other words, it's when we focus on trying to uproot the weeds, right? It's like, don't go out trying to poison weeds, right? Mm. Because you actually poison the wheat as well. Yeah. And I think in our time with, and this has tended to happen historically, whenever Christianity starts to wield a lot of power, particularly in democracies, when there's a lot of Christians and suddenly, right, let's force our way of seeing things, you know, on our society. Now, it's complex. And in some cases, I think, you know, we need to have a positive sort of influence. But again, Jesus is saying here, let the weeds grow. And we see in Romans chapter 1, you know, it says, you know, God gives people over to what they, if that's the way that God gives people over, right? So don't, I mean, of course we need to try to inhibit evil and we stand up for, you know, the weak and the, you know, all of this and try to curb evil in certain ways, but we've got to be very careful that we're not playing the moral crusader, you know, game. And in some cases, it's actually better for the gospel, let people do the wrong thing. God lets people do the wrong thing in the hope that they will realize that. And
as the parable says, if we get so distracted about chasing down the weeds, the chances are we're going to miss the wheat or pull the wheat up as well.
I think the good thing in Australia, and this isn't the case in many other countries, but in Australia, I think the good thing is that the church is losing political power.
Yeah.
And that's great for the gospel. Mm. Because again, the temptation to take hold of that political power and to, you know, is
which is a worldly power.
It's a worldly power, you know. Yep. So, you know, I think there's less and less temptation to do that. Look, at the same time, as I've said before, I'm seeing more people come into faith in the context of church now than I ever have in my, there's something, you know, in our context, there's a, God is doing something that I've not seen before. So anyway, so this is, you know, I think this is all here, right? The yeast, in other words, too, is spreading through the dough, right? It's not stopping. The seed of the kingdom is growing, okay? Yeah. Yeah. I think it's always when the church gets with the plan, picks up spiritual weapons, puts down worldly weapons. I know that's simplistic, and there are times when we wield worldly weapons that God gives us. There are examples of that, but let's not go to those examples to justify doing that all the time.
Yeah.
So the other thing that Jesus is going to underline here is to underline the distinction between weeds and wheat is the radical nature of discipleship. And he gives these parables. It's the parable of the hidden treasure, you know, the man who finds treasure in a field and he sells everything he has and he buys that field. Yeah. And then it's the same with the pearl, you know, the merchant finds a great pearl and he sells all that he has and he buys it. It's the giving up everything. Mm. It's later on, Jesus is going to say, you know, anyone who loses his life for me will find it. What is the good of gaining the whole world and yet you losing your soul? He's going to say that in a few chapters later here. So this is, again, you see what he's doing here. He is refining what discipleship means. He's not interested in crowds. He's interested in people who are going to become disciples. And to become a disciple, you give up every other agenda and you come under the agenda of the kingdom.
Yeah. So he's resetting purpose and, as a result of that, priorities.
Yes.
You know, it's like, you know, answer the call. We'll do whatever it takes to answer the call.
Yeah, that's right. And again, to underscore, to ensure that we don't play judge as to who the real and the not real Realers. People are, who the weeds and the wheat. He uses another example, a parable of the net, you know, which is the net's thrown out into the sea, and when it's full, it's drawn in.
Yes.
And then they sort out the good from the bad, right? Yeah. And this is at the end of the age. That's when
the sorting
the judgment happens. Yeah. Judgment is not our prerogative, and it's certainly not our mission. Mm. Again, to underscore the fact that he's not saying anything new here, he says, therefore, the scribe who has been trained in the kingdom of heaven, because he's just talked a lot about the kingdom of heaven.
Yes.
He says, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. So essentially, this teaching is almost, it's almost like he's founding a new scribal, almost a new kind of rabbinic school here in a way. And yet it's old and new.
Yes.
It's
not throwing out.
That's right. He's not throwing out what's old. Mm. He's bringing out the old and new.
Yeah.
So, and of course, I think to cap, I mean, this is the way that Matthew constructs these and puts these accounts together, I think is so important, because all of that about weeds and wheat and true discipleship and who hears and who doesn't hear, he goes back to his hometown of all places. And Luke, by the way, gives us in Luke chapter 4, gives us an expanded version of this. You know, he goes to his hometown and they will have none of it, right? And in fact, as Luke says, they try to kill him. They try to throw him off a cliff.
Yeah.
And I've actually been to the place where they try to do that. You know, take him to the mountain and of course he's preserved, but he is not honored in his hometown. This is the polarizing effect that he has. And it begins in his hometown.
And Jesus even says, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his household. Yeah.
So as we move into the next group of stories, almost like I think in many ways it highlights this theme of discipleship is almost that they are the heirs, you know, the promises to Israel in this sense. They are the new Israel. They are the remnant. You know, this is going back to that idea, that remnant theology. Because we have a group of stories that echoes in many ways, and I think it's important in broad terms to see these next stories a little bit like this, as something like the Exodus story. Yeah. You know, we sort of have
through the wilderness.
Yeah. So first of all, the king, Herod the Tetrarch, is going to, this is Herod Antipas, who's the Tetrarch of Galilee, from the death of Herod the Great. After Herod the Great, the kingdom gets sort of divided up, and you know Herod hears about this, and I mean it's interesting because Herod had imprisoned John the Baptist,
yes,
and this, we're told about this here, and it actually had John the Baptist executed somewhat reluctantly, but this is an interesting story in this context as well because. You know, okay, he's reluctant, but he gets drawn that way. This is the polarizing effect, even that John has at this point, because John had rebuked Herod
for marrying his brothers.
Yeah, that's right, Herodias. It's a bit confusing, but he had married his brother's wife, and that's kind of against the law. He thinks he can get away with that, but you know, to openly criticize a king, risky. So John the Baptist is beheaded. Herodias, and Mark tells us more about the scheme that she, you know, gets her daughter to dance, and knowing that he's going to make an extravagant offer to Salome, the daughter. What do you want? She, of course, asks for John the Baptist's head on a platter, and that's what leads to his execution. And so there's this moment of decision that Herod is drawn into, and he ends up on the polarization here. So he ends up, he is, in other words, there's a Pharaoh kind of thing that happens here, right?
Yep.
He is pushed, you know, his heart is hardened in a sense, right?
Yeah.
So as a result, because he's in this Herod's, you know, he's executed John the Baptist. So now he's really paranoid, right? Now his heart's really hardened. So Jesus goes out into the wilderness. And this again is, you know, indicative of, you know, the Exodus, the people going out into the wilderness.
Yeah.
And it's out in the wilderness. And of course, in the Exodus story, you know, they're in danger of starving in the wilderness. And God gives them a miraculous provision of food, of, yeah. of food, right? Manna and quail, yeah. right? Manna from heaven and, and quail, of course. And so what we're going to see Jesus doing here, and this is the famous feeding of the 5,000, he is going to, and it could have well have been more than 5,000 because—
they didn't count the men in those days.
5,000 men, unless, of course, it is 5,000 men, because one commentary that I read suggested that 5,000, it's 5,000 men, almost like that they were getting ready to, like men were coming out to be part of his military resistance.
Right, okay.
I think that's somewhat a long shot. I think probably there's women and children here, which
well,
you're talking
that they say
potentially
now,
15 to 20,000.
Yeah, which at the end, verse 21, now those who ate were about 5,000 men besides the women and children. So clearly.
Yeah, there's a couple of ways of, you know, but I think most likely, yeah, it's 15 to 20,000 and there are women and children here because a boy brings this.
Aside, whether it's 5,000 or 20,000, it's still—
it's a lot of people, that's the point.
With a few fish and a couple of those, you know.
So you see there's this miraculous— this is, I think, the point, this is miraculous feeding. Also, the language that Jesus used, you know, he takes it, he breaks it, he gives thanks.
Yeah.
This is harking forward now to the Lord's Supper, to the Eucharist. That's going to become central to the Christian community. Yeah. So the other thing that we see in the Exodus, so you get the miraculous provision of food, but you know there's the parting of the sea, and they go through the sea, and here we see you know Jesus walking on the water as well, and so again you get them harking back to the miracle of the parting of the sea in Exodus. Now the significance of in Exodus, the significance of course of the parting of the sea is that in the ancient world, bodies of water, whether they, I mean, this is, of course, the Sea of Galilee, it's a large lake, but certainly bodies of water were seen as sort of being the gates to the underworld,
yes.
in a sense, and the realm of chaos in a sense, right? You think of a, you know, storm at sea, it feels chaotic. You can, you know, that imagery is there. And so the parting of the sea in Exodus is significant because it's holding back the forces of chaos and death that were really the most feared things. This is a sort of upgrade of that because the sea isn't parted here, but Jesus walks on top of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's this sort of mastery of the forces of chaos and death here that he has. He walks on the water. It's enormously significant given the symbolism
of water.
Of the water. And of course, Peter, you know, says, call me out to come with you. Mm. Now, you know, question is this Peter being impulsive, sort of getting in a bit literally out of his depth, because he steps out into the water. At first, he walks on the water, but he looks and he freaks out and then he starts to sink and he has to cry out to Jesus. I mean, some commentators suggest that Peter's being a bit impulsive here. I reckon that's unkind. I think Peter's on a journey here, you know. And
well, the other disciples to learn thought it was a ghost, and it's like they were afraid because they thought it was a ghost, and then Jesus calls out to them, have courage, it is I, don't be afraid. And so Peter kind of says, if it is you, then command me to come out and walk with you, kind of thing, almost trying to make the point, no, I believe this is Jesus, and I'm going to step out. As you say, he did okay until he took his eyes off Jesus.
And I think that's a good indication of what faith is as well, because one of the things that Matthew is emphasizing is the importance of faith. And, you know, there's that repeated phrase, oh, you of little faith. It's the thing that, you know, it's interesting because he doesn't bemoan, he doesn't say, oh, you sinful people. But what he most bemoans is lack of faith. That's the thing that concerns Jesus the most. And it's when Peter looked at the elements and focused on that, and it was the fear and so forth that essentially sort of eroded that initial what was the seed of faith.
Yeah.
So, you know, interesting definition of faith associated with that connection with Jesus.
But at least he got out of the boat.
He got out of the boat, that's right.
You know, I mean, we hear lots of sermons about that, but I think there's an element of that faith of being willing to take the step, even though you can't see how this is going to work out, believing in God's call and stepping out. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So he gets off the boat in the region of Gennesaret. This is Gentile territory. Mm. And I mean, this is interesting foray into Gentile territory here. And I think this connects with this section on clean and unclean here, because he's going into Gentile territory. He's going to make a very important point. And what we're going to see here in Matthew 15 is an anticipation of the gospel going to the Gentiles.
Yeah.
Now, the Gentiles were seen as the great unclean, and you don't mix with Gentiles because that, you know, we're holy, they're unholy, yeah. we're yeah. clean, they're unclean, right?
Yeah.
So, and yet Jesus is going to go and minister amongst, you know, the unclean, and he's going to impart cleanliness, just like he did with the leper
yeah.
back in chapter 8.
But their uncleanness was much more around ritual and tradition than it was about heart, and I think this is the point Jesus is going to make now.
He's going to find, when he's bemoaning the lack of faith of his own people, he's going to find amazing faith here amongst the Gentiles. He has already in chapter 8. We've seen the centurion showing yeah. great faith. But it's interesting at this point that there are a whole lot of Pharisees have come from Jerusalem. They're very concerned about what's going on. This is part of the polarization now. They're coming to check him out. You get the sense they're really looking for something to catch him out with.
Yeah.
I mean,
and let's be aware that at this point when he stepped off the shore, there's already hundreds of people there.
Yeah.
And there are people just touching his robe and being healed. So there's clearly Jesus is doing something
yeah.
amongst the Gentiles or the unclean.
Yeah.
Again, now the Pharisees and the scribes from Jerusalem are coming to go, hang on, this isn't.
And they're watching. They're standing yeah. by. They're listening to everything he says and yeah. they're watching everything they do. Now, they notice that they eat and, mm. and the disciples didn't wash their hands first.
Yeah. So to me, it's like you're watching all these people being healed.
Yeah.
You know, by just touching Jesus's robe, and you're worried that they didn't wash their hands before they had their Big Mac. You know, it's like, seriously?
Talk about polarization,
oh, man,
isn't it?
Goodness.
I mean, yeah, they are watching amazing miracles being done,
and yet they're trying to trip them up on yeah. technicalities, in a sense.
Yeah, you know? That's right. So you know, they notice that these yep. disciples don't, and they pick him up on this.
Yeah,
and he says, "Okay, all right. Well, while we're on nitpicking."
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like you guys, you have these traditions that you put in place that act like loopholes. So, for example, a son can dedicate, because, you know, an eldest son is responsible for his family and sharing everything, you know, with the rest of his family. And in order to keep that to himself, there's this loophole in the law where you can, if I dedicate these fruit trees to the temple, right?
Right.
It's like a bequest.
Right.
But while I'm alive, right,
I get to keep them.
I get to keep them.
But
also,
I
therefore don't have to share them because, oh, no, sorry, I can't share with the rest of my family.
Dedicated to the
temple. Because, yeah. oh, yeah, it's dedicated to the temple. So it's like this loophole that they were fine with using so that they didn't have to share their yeah. possessions and honor parents in this way. It's like Jesus yeah. is saying, you guys, honestly, you're tripping me up on this one thing and your own codes are rife with compromise, right? Mm. And so
talk about throw the yeah, baby out with the bathwater.
Exactly. Yeah.
Big way.
Exactly. Goodness so, me. And he, you know, he quotes, you know, Isaiah, these people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. Now, he's not winning friends by.
No.
I mean, these are important people that come to see him, right? Mm. And he just gives it to them straight, like John the Baptist, right? So, pretty much from this time, they're going to.
It's right, polarization.
He's a write off. Yeah, it's polarization. And then he's going to talk about true defilement, right? Essentially, he is getting to the heart of things. You know, they've been so concerned about outward laws because he's just said there, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me, right?
Yeah.
So what comes from the heart that defiles a person, not what goes into the stomach.
Mm.
Now, that's already an important spiritual lesson. But what he's going to show now is that he's going to meet a Gentile that actually has a way better heart than any of his own people do.
Yeah.
And this, the placement of the story of this Canaanite woman in that region is a very important story in this context, right? Because, you know, she's going to display a heart and she's going to be rendered clean. In fact, her daughter is going to be delivered from an unclean spirit,
yeah.
right? That's
yeah.
a very important connection here with these sections. And she's going to be delivered from an unclean spirit because of this woman's heart of faith, right? Now, the context is going to help explain why Jesus seems to be pretty hard on this woman as well, Stu. I mean, this looks pretty mean, this next story, I reckon.
Yeah.
Like, because a woman comes out of concern for a daughter. This is a...
Yes.
So she's a Canaanite. This is important. She's a Canaanite woman. So definitely outside.
That's
the calling her that evokes the idea of the Canaanites as this terrible people, you know, living in the land, right? you know, in the time of Moses and, you know, one of the people that should have been driven out. She's, look, she's broadly speaking Canaanite. She's actually, Mark refers to her as a Syrophoenician woman. So she's a, now that doesn't help because the other famous Phoenician woman was Jezebel.
Yes.
Right. You know, but there are also cases in the time of Elijah, there was a woman who also shows faith as well. This is an important moment, which is why it's going to be drawn out because when she cries out to him, he actually ignores her.
Yeah.
It says and he didn't answer a word. Like, and the text is very emphatic. Mm. He's not even going to.
To the point that it started to annoy his disciples.
She has to keep, she has to keep crying out. Mm. And the disciples come to Jesus and say to him, you've got to get rid of this woman. She keeps on crying out. This is what Jesus is wanting to demonstrate to them because she's not giving up, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And he makes a point here to her. I've come to the lost sheep of Israel, right? Your turn will come, but I've come to the lost sheep of Israel. Mm. She even then won't give up.
Yeah.
Remember, all of this, she is going to be commended here. This is drawing something out. And then he says something which is nigh on insulting. I mean.
Well, she came and knelt before him first and said, Lord, help me.
Right. He says it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.
Yeah, that.
Pretty harsh. I mean, look. Softened a little bit by the fact that he doesn't use the word that's usually used of unclean dogs that frequent a rubbish dumps. And the term that was used as a term of derision by Jews about Gentile dogs.
Yep.
It's little dog or almost pet. It's
not the
pets,
one.
You know, it softens it a bit, but there's still a, and look, he's using something that was probably a parable of the time. So I don't think it's as, it's not quite, given that it's a saying at the time, it's not quite as probably mean as what it strikes us. And yet there's still an element of intentional repellent here. Mm-hmm. Now, he's pushing her away. This is almost like Jacob wrestling the angel.
Yes.
This is what this reminds me of. You know, there's this wrestle that he allows to happen and she's not going to let go. She's like Jacob saying, I will not let you go until you bless me.
Yeah. And or even Job to some degree.
That's right. And and when she says, yes, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall beneath the table, you know, there's this unyielding faith, right? And he stands back. This is one of the very few moments where he stands back and he says, folks, this is what faith is, where he commends someone's faith. It almost never happens.
Yeah.
Happened with the centurion and it happens with a Canaanite woman. So the two,
outsiders.
So far, the two
fairly
outstanding
big
examples of faith that Jesus highlights are from a centurion and a Canaanite woman, right? Yeah.
Who from the Jewish point of view would have been considered the rankest outsiders.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, this is remarkable. And she is essentially cleansed and her daughter is cleansed. This is linking into what we've seen about what defiles a person. She is cleansed through her faith.
You know,
this is what Paul's going to talk about. You know, it's salvation through faith, right? It's the willingness to hold, you know, I will not let you go. And it's the faith that entrusts, that sells everything, that completletely putting your life in God's hands completely.
I have nothing else unless you do this for me. Yeah,
that's right. And this continues, actually. You know, it's not just her. It's the next section emphasizes from verse 29 of chapter 15, chapter 15.
Yes.
That Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee. And this is up in the north, right? The north part of the Sea of Galilee is that region of the Gennesaret, is Gentile territory.
Large crowds came to him, including the lame, the blind, the crippled, those unable to speak, and many others. They put them at his feet, and he healed them.
That's right. And it goes on to say, and they glorified the God of Israel.
Yes.
And this is an important statement that Matthew makes here that highlights the fact that this is Gentile territory. It's part of how we know he's still in Gentile territory, because here are Gentiles that are glorifying the God of Israel.
Wow.
So this is an echo of Queen of Sheba, another, you know, the healing of Naaman, where outsiders give more glory to the God of Israel than the Israelites are giving to the God of Israel, right?
Yeah.
This is exactly what's happening at this stage. And it's interesting too here that in this same region, the same miracle is performed.
Yes.
Of the feeding of the multitude.
Yeah.
So the feeding of the 4,000, I mean, people might wonder, why are there two accounts of
miraculous feedings? Yeah, and is it the same story and they're just slightly...
No, it's not the same story because this is actually Jesus doing the same miracle in Gentile territory because they too are included in this Exodus story, right? The Gentiles are going to be included in this great Exodus from spiritual oppression.
Yeah.
Okay, we've seen that spiritual oppression in the case of the Canaanite woman, right? And so these Gentiles are part of this new Israel. It's more loaves, it's fewer people, and yet there's a better response from them than...
Do you think this is chronologically in order? Because I wondered, why are the disciples, having seen what happened before, again asking the same question, well, where are we going to go and buy enough food to do this? It's like, do you not remember what I just did back here, you know?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is chronological probably at this point, given that... Well, at least I don't think that takes away from it, because the point that Matthew's making here in the construction of the story is like they still don't get it quite. Now, remember, Matthew is one of these guys. He's not pumping up their tires.
No, that's right.
Yeah. Nope. And this is the interesting thing about this. Normally, when you write this stuff, you'd really pump up your own tires. But this is not highlighting the virtues of human beings. This is pointing to Jesus. And I think the great thing about this, it shows that the disciples get there, right? But it takes a while, right? And Jesus is very patient with them. There's this rich kind of flow to these stories, Stu. And I just encourage, you know, readers, as you continue to read, always think about how the stories flow into one another and what they say about one another. But most of all, what this says about us. How is your faith? Are you expecting Jesus to follow you? Or are you really following Jesus? Are you dedicated to Jesus? Are you willing to put your life completely in his hands? Because that is what faith is.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.